I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's always a pleasure coming here. So Cliff Burgess and Louis LeBlanc and Sarah Shandera and I have been sort of concerned and studying various incoherent problems in that show with inflationary cosmology. And we think we have some interesting things to say about them. So there are a couple of papers that I want to try to touch upon today. I'll try to keep track of the time, but I suppose that's what you're there for. So let me just quickly go over the infrared issues, but Leonardo and I sort of talked about that yesterday, so the motivation for this will be pretty clear. And then the two pieces of work that we've done have to do with both the breakdown of the semi-classical approximation in the sitter and using a technique known as the dynamical renormalization group to resum some of the secular growing terms that show up when you do loop corrections in the sitter space. So I want to discuss those two things, and then sort of talk about some further directions that one can go from, with the results from these two topics. So, light fields in the sitter have long been known to have infrared problems, and they show up as either secular growth in two-point function, various flavors of time-dependent laws, or box size-dependent laws if you're doing one of these mosaic-type calculations. And basically, you have to worry that these long-distance problems, these late-time problems, are going to creep in and ruin any kind of perturbative description you might have for correlation functions of power spectrum, bispectrum, etc. And of course, I learned how to put it yesterday, Weinberg worries about these things, so perhaps we should all worry about these things. You'd have to argue that that's a pretty good reason. So let me first talk about, sort of in reverse order as to how we did the work, let me talk about first the breakdown of the semi-classical approximation in the sitter. And what you want to keep in mind is, the idea that you want to keep in mind is finite temperature. So in finite temperature field theory, you have this problem. If you have massless modes, you have enhanced infrared problems because the distribution function, say for a Bose-Einstein particle, has stronger divergences at k equals zero. So you can do the exercise of computing the most infrared, pick an amplitude, say with E external legs, I internal ones, and V vertices, the usual thing one does, and try to look at how badly infrared divergent can that quantity be. Right? So you go through the standard calculation, and you use the various conservation of ends and so forth, and you write an amplitude that looks like that. You have, for each vertex, you have delta functions, 1 over temperature. Those are all the internal pieces. And you want to look for the most infrared singular piece, so you'll set, in your Matsubara sum, you'll set n equal to 0, and say use the mass of your theory, the mass of the particle in your theory, to cut off the integration momenta. And what you find then is sort of, delta function, normal stuff. And then you find this, that your loop, the thing that's counting your loop expansion is not just a coupling, as you thought, but in fact, it's this combination of quantities. So at that point, you should take, there's cause for concern, right? So there are a couple of ways that you can play this in the finite temperature case. One is that suppose you did start off with a massless theory, truly massless. You know that you're going to get finite temperature corrections to the mass that will go like lambda t squared. And so you could put the lambda t squared down here, and what you would find is that your loop expansion parameter wasn't lambda like you thought it would be, but in fact, it's square root of lambda. And so you have the non-analytic behavior that's exhibited in when you look at, say, a high temperature expansion of the effective potential, looking at ring diagrams for the pressure, et cetera, you find this non-analytic behavior. What's more interesting, though, is suppose that you actually have a symmetry breaking situation where you have a negative mass squared initially. You do the hard thermal loop resummation to actually put the temperature-dependent mass in there, and then you look at what happens near the critical point. So near the critical point, the mass, that temperature-dependent mass goes to zero, and the loop expansion just breaks down. And that's basically, however you want to say it, that's a reflection of the fact that trying to compute critical exponents in mean field turns out to be a really bad idea, because near the critical temperature, near the phase transition, things are just going to go haywire. So this is what happens in finite temperature. And you could imagine that because the standard lore is that the sitter is kind of like being at finite temperature in some in various ways. You could imagine that it's not outlandish to worry, at least, that something like that might also happen in the sitter. So that's a calculation we undertook to do. And let me first give you the answers, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what happens when you try to calculate it. So in fact, something like that happens. So what you get is that, whereas you thought that lambda was your expansion parameter, in fact, it's root lambda h over 2 pi m. Okay? And so the loop expansion will break down. If your mass is too small, and it's given by that, if your mass is too small, the loop expansion breaks down. And again, you can imagine same situations where either you just put in what we'll call the dynamically generated mass, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, into here, and you get some new some non-analytic behavior in your expansion parameter. Or again, if you have some initially negative mass squared term in your theory, and then you include this dynamical mass, you can get points where the total mass goes to zero, and you have a very light particle, and your loop expansion breaks down. So this is the end result of that calculation, and I'll talk a little bit about some consequences of that, and then I'll go back and talk about how we made the estimate.
You know, you take lambda to I lambda or something like that, and you show that there's an instability.
So that lambda, yeah, so that somehow lambda equals zero as an analytic point.
Yeah, exactly.
It could well be. I mean, I haven't really looked at that. Usually just see it by trying to actually resum the loop diagrams. But there could be an interesting way of thinking about that.
Yeah.
Have you done the graviton?
Excuse me?
Have you done the graviton?
No, we haven't done the graviton. Steve's done the gravitons. So he'll talk about that on Friday. So yeah, so just to be sure what we're doing, spectator scalar and a background desitter. Background eternal desitter. So there's also so one of the directions one can go to afterwards is suppose it's not eternal, suppose you're trying to look at back reactions, suppose it's the graviton and so forth. So we haven't done that. We're just looking at just a pure scalar in the set. Okay? So let me just look at a standard sort of inflationary model with a quartic potential and look at what happens, for example, in a large field. There are various interesting places in field space for the large field for large field inflation. One is where a slow roll ends. One is where eternal inflation begins, where you start to break, it's where it's sort of the you start to lose control of the low energy approximation to the theory, and the place where the semi-classical approximation breaks down. And so in the large field case, basically I can just toss everything away and just keep the 5/4 piece. And what I want to do is just delineate where these regimes fall. And what, as you can see, in terms of if I worry about it parametrically in lambda, what I find is sort of what you expect to find, that slow roll is less than where eternal inflation starts, is less than where you start to lose control of the low energy approximation, and is less than the breakdown of the semi-classical approximation. So basically, for the large field case, you can pretty much do everything you wanted to do before you hit the regime where the semi-classical approximation breaks down. Okay, so in this case, we basically have nothing to say in terms of dangerous things other than, you know, there is a regime in field space where things would go bad, but by and large, things will have gone much further bad long before that, at least parametrically in lambda. On the other hand, I can try to look at what happens at small field, and for a variety of reasons, I want to really concentrate on what happens when I look at a hybrid inflation model. So I think about sitting at the chi equals zero, chi as a cross field. I think about sitting in the chi equals zero trough and rolling down in the phi direction. So effectively, I have the same kind of potential that I wrote down before. But what I can now do, for example, is keep the end of slow roll, the phi that tells me about the end of slow roll, I can decouple that from the quartic parameter. So those are independent. So I can tune those so that I'm still in slow roll, even though phi is small.
So I now look at everything in a small phi approximation, where basically the potential is just a V naught. The effective mass squared I can basically treat as just the mass squared parameter. And I find that if I am to remain within the regime where the semi-classical approximation is good, I have to satisfy this relationship.
Five.
Right.
Mass of chi now.
No, I'm talking about the mass of
phi, the effective mass of phi. Okay, so basically I set chi to zero while I'm inflating. I take two derivatives. This is the effective mass squared for phi. Okay? And in the small field limit, the effective mass squared for phi is just m squared. So the point is, so I can replace it, I can just use the Einstein equation and replace h squared by v naught. The point is that I can now actually look at what happens to, say, the slow roll parameter eta. And what I find is that if you are going to be within the regime where the slow roll, where the semi-classical approximation is good, where you can still do the loop expansion, eta, it has a lower bound. Not an upper one, but a lower one. And so, you know, you're usually in small coupling, so this is not necessarily so bad in terms of worrying about whether or not you're going to be in the slow roll regime. Nonetheless, it is a constraint that has to be satisfied. And it's important to note, it's not a constraint that you can sort of get around by doing more loops. The whole point is the loops break down past that. Right, so...
Pretty much, that's what
you've
seen. I mean, there's no mass.
Well, so it's not okay. So it.
Because phi, the whole point is that phi for the integral, you don't care. I mean, zeta outside the right, the constant value of zeta. There might be other integrals.
Right, so I agree.
So technically, I would want to compute, really look at what happens to zeta and, you know, sort of following what Steve has done and feed that back into here. So, okay, fair enough. Nonetheless, so it may not be the slow roll parameter, but technically, this is still a true statement.
Is it an extra parameter?
Well, V0 is the constant piece that you get when you set chi to zero.
Okay.
Because you're sitting in that trough.
Okay, good. Okay. So that's a free parameter.
You right.
Can adjust the right. Things work out.
Right. And that's kind of, you know, modulo Matthias's comment. That's why we wanted to do this hybrid thing, because various pieces get decoupled, so you don't have to worry about falling in regimes where you want one thing to happen where you can't have it happen. So this is sort of a nice picture to sort of delineate differences between thermal and the sitter cases. So these are the corrections. This is the regime where the semi-classical approximation breaks down. So this is for thermal, and this is for the Vita Sitter case. This dynamical mass, so this would be the finite temperature mass that you would generate. And this, as we'll talk about in the second section, this is the dynamical mass that you generate through these infrared instability, through these infrared issues. And finally, this is the biggest mass that you can have and still either still be affected by these infrared fluctuations. So parametrically, you can see. And so parametrically, you can see that the lambda dependence is different between the sitter and thermal, which is telling you that at some level, the sitter is not exactly like thermal. Okay, and you might have seen. You know, so whereas in terms of particle detector, the
sitter looks thermal. There are some places where the effects are qualitatively similar, but parametrically quantitatively different.
I'll just close on to the statement that the de Sitter temperature is of order h bar. I mean, because there's implicitly h bars in your. Well,
I mean, there are the h bars showing up in thermal field theory as well. I mean, these are all quantum corrections.
We're doing lambda.
Yeah. I mean, if you tried to talk about a thermal ensemble at a temperature that is proportional to h bar, for example, and then you reorganized your perturbation expansion to think about it as an expansion in order h bar instead of order lambda, is that enough? Is that how I should understand this change in the power of lambda? Okay, maybe that's
yeah, we'll talk about that later. I think these bars shake out the same way, but yeah,
we can get back to that.
Consider temperature proportional to h.
Right. Right. So
h is t.
H is t. So
yeah. Lambda is.
Lambda is lambda.
Part of the fourth is.
Right.
for h bar equals 1.
But that, yeah, this is all with h bar equals 1. So if I put the h bars in there, so what he's asking is whether there are different powers of h bar showing up here that would account for the difference in the coupling constant dependence.
Right.
My answer is I'm not sure. I don't think that's how it shakes out.
You can talk about a loop expansion and powers of lambda, but also implicitly that's usually powers of h bar. But because there's explicit h bars that come into the temperature of De Sitter space, you might need to reorganize that thinking somehow, and it's just not entirely.
Yeah, so
that might be related.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but of course, so you can and you can see also that the
effect of the temperature dependent masses also get different powers, and I think I don't know that the H bar argument would flow the same way there. So I don't think that's how it shakes out. So, okay, so those are sort of the results, and let me talk a little bit about how we actually do the power counting, because it's a little more subtle than the finite temperature case. In fact, it's a lot more subtle than the finite temperature case. And so what we have to do is basically do in-in formalism. We have to actually, we're tracking amplitudes that vary in time. And so the usual thing, everybody knows about this by now, but we look at a closed time contour, a plus contour and a minus contour, so the field content gets doubled, and the action that you use, essentially a minus sign because the time contour has an opposite direction coming back, you use this action, and it contains this sort of piece in the potential, and it turns out to be a lot easier to work with things if you go to relative and center of mass coordinates, so to speak. In those coordinates, you see that you don't have a direct mass term, you have a mixing term, and these are your phi to the fourth interactions. And the reason that's nice, it's nice to do it in those variables as opposed to just the plus and the minus, is that as opposed to there being, say, four correlation functions that you would get in the plus and the minus version of things, there are really only two. So there is the center of mass correlator, and that's where the infrared issues really show up. And then there is the cross correlator, which is essentially a retarded Green's function. Okay, there, and the relative correlator is zero, basically because of an identity relating G plus plus, G plus minus, G minus plus, etc. So now what we want to do is actually go through the same calculation as before, where we have an amplitude with so many internal lines, so many external lines, so many vertices, and look at that amplitude and try to count up powers of the coupling. And we have to be a little bit careful. If I look at these mixed propagators, I have to worry about which part of the line connects up to the vertex. So I have to split up the external delta or the external delta lines into two pieces depending on which part of it is it's connecting.
Can you implement using bunch data stacking or?
Yeah. No, so we're completely in bunch stages. Okay. And so now I have two types of vertices, one where I have three center of masses, one relative, and the other one where I have three relatives, one center of mass. So that's my vertex count, that's my ends count. And now we sit down, and this is the amplitude that you would write down when you factor out the overall delta function for momentum conservation. And it's, you know, it's a mess, right? But you get, let's see, this is the h squared over 2k cubes that you get in the center of mass correlator. That's how many of those I have. For each vertex, I have to do a time integral with an h to the fourth, and a is 1 over h, a is minus 1 over h, a tau, for tau is informal time. These are the pieces I get for the cross-Green's function. And then momentum integrals, and delta functions. So it's a mess. And it's actually more of a mess than you think, because if you ask the questions, where are the time integrals going? What are the limits of the time integrals? So first of all, I have a lot of theta functions that are retarding things, so all those time integrals are nested. Furthermore, the integrals themselves, the lower limit of the integrals, are actually momentum dependent, and they actually could depend on the internal momentum.
Essentially, because if I'm looking at these time integrals and looking at these mode functions, once I go to times that are before, once the mode function comes back into the horizon, it starts oscillating enough so that essentially the effects wash away. So my time integrals really start from when that those modes left the horizon onward. So that makes it more difficult. If I do things with a cutoff, the momentum integrals also have time dependence because I'm using a fixed physical cutoff. So therefore, in co-moving, I have time dependence. So very hard to do. And of course, even just having external times, that's going to complicate how you do the dimensional analysis. There's something else with units in there. So putting all that together, it's much easier to actually go back into real space and try to do the calculation there. And so what I'm going to do is basically Fourier transform this back into real space and compute a specific correlation function that makes my life easier, or our life easier. And so let me look at the correlator of, I think I actually meant, this should be a center of, no, this is right. No, it's two C's, right? Yeah.
That was two C's. Yeah, unfortunate.
So I'm going to look at this correlator with the same point here. Okay? So then I can actually use the De Sitter invariance to sort of tell me what shouldn't show up in the answer. And trust me, we did do this. And what you get at the end is, in terms of the infrared cutoff, I have some power of the infrared cutoff that when you look at it in terms of number of external lines, number of vertices, et cetera, they all conspire to add up to zero. So basically what that's saying is, in these graphs, the worst you can get are logs. You don't get any power divergence. You just get logs. So that's good. So the next question is, does it get worse? So, you know, as I go to higher loop, does the situation get worse? Does it stay at just one log? Do I get more logs? What actually happens? And so we look at this. So you should look at all diagrams. Let's look at one diagram, which makes the work finite. So what we did is we did this iterated self-energy diagram and actually computed what shows up in here. And when all said and done, you look at the correction to this two-point function, and it looks like the zeroth order piece times this log to the Lth power. So in fact, not only do you get logs, and which is kind of what you would have hoped for, but furthermore, the logs get worse as you go to higher loop order. The logs get worse. Okay. So ultimately, if you look at this factor, so this epsilon, we've introduced a little mass in here to regulate things. So if you look at this factor, that's exactly.
Tau's conformal time,
right? Tau's conformal time. I'm evaluating that correlator at some fixed conformal time.
No,
I mean because it's the same time here and here. I'm not. Okay.
So,
if you look at this piece, lambda over epsilon, and put in this is epsilon for this is the epsilon parameter for this. If you put that in, you get exactly the loop counting factor that we were getting. That it's square root of lambda h over 2 pi m all to the 2l. So ultimately, you're going to see that. So we weren't kidding. You actually do see this, at least in this particular class of graphs. Now, what we haven't proven, what would have been nice to prove, is that that this shows up for all possible graphs. I mean, so what we know for all possible graphs, or all possible graphs that compute this, that you do only get these log divergences. We'd like to do it for all correlators, but that's just a lot harder. And so, well, M is just a mass in the theory. I mean, the theory has a mass. Okay. The whole point is to argue that at small mass, the loop expansion breaks down. So we'll put a mass in and look at the small mass limit and look at the infrared piece of it. Okay? So it's true. For low enough mass, the semi-classical the loop expansion breaks down. Okay. Now, you could argue, so you may hope, or you could try to hope, that there is a full resummation of this. We certainly don't see it. We don't see things falling in together to show up as a resummation. It could shake out for some reason that it does, but we don't see that. Okay. So we leave it at this. As far as we can calculate, we do see this breakdown in semi-classical approximation.
And then try and continue with that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, this is like the Merrill paper. Right, so actually, glad you brought that up, because in fact the Merrill paper does agree with our power counting, at least to one loop. So, you know.
Well, in particular, in their examples, you also get this 1 over m, powers of 1 over m in the corrections to the two-point function. So you do see the same strong IR behavior for small enough m.
Yeah, so certainly there's enough outside evidence that this power counting seems to be right.
Maybe a very naive question. So you take 5-4 theory, right?
Yeah.
And you tell that at the critical point where the mass is zero, Minfield breaks down. But we knew it from Wilson's solution. So what you were expecting to find?
Well, I mean,
first of all, I know that if there's a phase transition, I would expect that. There's no phase, and there's really no phase transition here. I have a light 5-4.
Well, it seemed like in the other context, it would be like critical point if you were, like in the Wilson sense, right? When you consider 5-4 theory in of the phase transition, like second order phase transition, you put M going to zero, then
sure.
Basically approaching critical point. And of course, the mean field will break down loop exponential, this class for approximately breaks down.
Sure. But if I had a different FRW,
if it wasn't the sitter and I didn't have this. I didn't have this infrared behavior, I wouldn't see any of that.
I certainly agree from the following perspective that if I really am thinking of the sitter as kind of thermalish, right, then we can play that game and we expect the same kind of behavior to show up. And in fact, that kind of was what motivated us. But so if you want to think of it from that perspective, it's no surprise it should have happened this way. And I'm just exhibiting it exactly in a time, in a place where there's time dependence, all sorts of stuff going on. But yeah.
Sorry, but when you're doing the mean field, this is what I was arguing yesterday. When you do the mean field, actually those diagrams are really what give you the Fermi mass square of the lambda factor of the fourth theory. Mm-hmm. This is lambda a square.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put the Fermi mass.
So
in fact, you can really check, which is what we did, that is actually the Taylor expansion of the summation. So what I was showing yesterday, okay, then we can discuss more about that, is the summation of those diagrams.
No, okay, but what we're arguing is that when you do, so that would be equivalent to what you do in finite temperature as a hard thermal loop summation. And that's what puts the temperature dependent mass on the bottom of the coupler. So I'm saying, now suppose that full mass is now very small. So I agree with you in some sense.
But if you do that, these loops you've already put in, then you are double counting the loops. Because that effective mass is like computing all these loops at the summit. Then you don't do it again. The sum of all these loops gives you the effective mass.
Mm-hmm.
And then these loops have done it.
Right, so they're done. But you will agree that if my mass parameter is small,
there is no more this diagram.
But do we all agree on what's going on? And is that you get an accumulation from the modes that have crossed outside the horizon. All of this is classical stochastic things, really, in combining, I guess. And all that's happening is if you put a mass to zero, in your perturbation, it takes an infinite amount. The thing goes up, it never comes down. So a mode that crossed the horizon and moved your sigma or whatever your field is up, it just stays up forever. Even with a mass, or with a lambda, with any potential, the thing comes down. So the number of defaults over which this fluctuation can operate and affect things is finite. And so you would not get an infrared divergence, it would just how long it takes to come down. You know, you may as well just solve for how long it takes to come down, and that's the end of the story, right? I don't think there's any... By putting mass to zero, you're making the thing stay up there forever, and so that's why it looks like it's diverging. But even in lambda 5 to the 4th, if you were not doing perturbative, it also comes down. So because the thing comes down, there's no real problem. I mean, it takes a long time to come down, it's a bigger problem. Or it's a bigger effect. Log gets a little bit bigger. The number of defaults.
Right,
but what it is, that is just the number of defaults it takes to get down. So, I don't know. It's not so bad. It's
First,
that is doing resummation of this stuff.
Yeah, this is the resummation of this, but it's pretty off. I mean, it's just like not.
But for small enough M, you get into something I think that's a little bit more akin to self-reproduction, where we know that the, say, the global structure of the thing is quite.
Well, first of all, this is a spectator field, okay? So, I don't think we have to get into the self-reproduction for this calculation. We can take that into account for. I mean, let's just, if we want to do that case, let's just do that case. But let's just not try to. So this is a spectator field. The sitter is fixed for this calculation. So let's just keep the calculation where. So, and if you put the mass to zero from lambda 5 to the 4th, it will also go down. It just doesn't stay there, right? So you have to resum it, and that's the.
Right. I think the same idea. If the mass equals zero, you can resum and you generate. You have the mass. Yeah, the fermion mass.
Yeah, so you can may as well just, that's the answer.
So at this point, but you still could have a tuned physical mass, which after you do the resummation, the physical mass would still be
small. Yeah. Right, I mean, that's what happens in a phase transition, right?
Yeah, but do you want to say that a particle up in a potential, which is lambda sigma to the fourth, doesn't come down, even without the mass? You don't need the mass to come down.
Yeah, to come down. It doesn't need a mass to come down. It's not the man.
No, but if I want to compute, okay, so we have near term quantity transition,
right? So the mass zero, just quantity interaction, the particles always come down.
If the mass is small enough, it never comes down, just like in self-reproduction, because the...
Sorry, in lambda 5 to the 4th, it doesn't come down if you don't have a mass? Well, just m equals to 0, lambda 5 to the 4th, doesn't come down?
It also depends on smallness of, let me see, I guess of lambda as well.
So, I mean... So. Okay, but the resummation is however long it takes it to come down. I mean, if then you want to put lambda to zero, then you have a shift symmetry, then there's just no effect. I mean, then it can stay there forever, but it doesn't have any effect.
So that would be like the case of the
graviton? Right, exactly. So, fine. I mean, anyway.
But I mean, I don't think there is any disagreement here. It's just that, okay, so there are these log divergences and you're not too unhappy about them, so I...
clearly cuts off.
But I mean, this perturbative technique doesn't work.
We're saying is that if you try to just stick to the standard loop extension, that at small enough mass, that you're going to have a problem.
Yeah,
and then you can resum, you can do various things. That, and all I'm trying to do here is delineate sort of how bad the problem shakes out.
Is the statement that when you do that resumming, the mass will always be pushed up above the thermal scale? Is that?
I suggest we complete that discussion discussion session and let
Okay. So this is all I want to say for this part. And in fact, the part with the resummation, we'll get to some of these things. So sort of conclusions part one.
You're right.
Okay, so let me get to the second piece, because I think it also feeds into this discussion. So basically, there's secular growth in there. There are two types of secular logs. One that shows up if you have a finite, some non-eternal de Sitter. One that just shows up when you're counting number of vehicles after a mode crosses the horizon and up to some time tau. And these are the ones I'm going to concentrate on. So if you look at the tableau graph and put in a mass counter term to make everything all right, what you find is that there's infrared problems, as we've been talking about. And of course, you know that the infrared cutoff is unphysical. So somehow what it's really a signal of is that you've missed some important physics that ought to be dealing with that infrared cutoff. And so the question is, what kind of physics do you put in? And for logs, it's interesting that you can actually do the ultraviolet piece of the calculation and get laws of a subtraction point over the infrared cutoff. And somehow, whatever infrared physics you're going to put in will have to involve that log of the infrared piece times some scale L that contains the physics that's actually dealing with your infrared problem. So that when they combine, the coefficient has to be the same, and you just get log of your subtraction point times your scale L that deals with your new infrared physics. So the question is, there are two possibilities for our case of what L can be. So for example, L can be time independent, which is what's going to show up when you have an eternal de Sitter. Or if you have some pre-inflationary physics, like a non-set to inflation, your L will depend on time. But ultimately, at some point, you have to decide what is the physics that's here in your infrared problem, because your physical observables should not be infrared singular. So use that. Let's go back to that propagator, that correction that we looked at. Here's what we started off with the infrared cutoff. We know that whatever the new physics is, it's going to shake out to give us a mu times an L and these secular logs. So the question now arises, how can I resum those secular terms and actually get an answer that I might trust sort of beyond, you know, at late times? And also, how do I go around figuring out what the physics is that fixes my infrared problem? So this is where the renormalization group is going to be useful. So let me remind you of how it works in standard calculations. You compute a one loop corrected coupling, and it depends on your subtraction point. And its domain, the domain of validity of the theory is not just that alpha has to be small, it's at whatever fiducial point you have, but in fact, alpha times these logs also has to be small. Okay? And so, by the miracle of differentiating with respect to mu and then integrating with respect to mu, I can actually extend the domain of validity of the theory. I have this relationship now, and now that's actually valid for just alpha much less than 1, not alpha log. So I've extended the domain of validity of it, and basically that's what I want to do. In the time-dependent case, I want to find some way to take that, to take my correction, which clearly is of limited validity in time. If I wait too long, that correction is going to get too large. I want to find some way of doing this trick in the time-dependent case. And that's what the dynamical RG is. So this is a technique that was introduced by Goldenfeld, Chen, and Ono. And it looks just the same. So suppose I do a calculation, and I get something that has secular growth. I get some solution that has zeroth piece, and the correction to it is actually growing in time. And so what I'll do is, I have to introduce my subtraction parameter, the equivalent to mu. So I'll add and subtract some y1 at some fake time, funny theta. And then I can actually rewrite that in terms of, I can absorb this piece into here, and rewrite that as y0 of the integration constant, but now in terms of this new parameter and in this difference. Okay? Then I know that I've done nothing. So therefore, when I take this, cannot depend on funny theta, I take that derivative, that's my RG equation, and I can solve it to get the constant as a function of theta. I'll put that back in, and I get this relationship. And now what I'll do at the end of the day is I'll set this theta, which I can choose to be anything, I'll set it equal to t, and that gives me a new solution to the problem that is good not only for, this solution would only be good as long as epsilon y1 over y0 is small, because that's controlling the growth. This solution is good as long as only epsilon is small. So again, I have increased the domain of validity of the theory. And the example that we care about is this one, where I have some constant 1 plus something growing. That's what's showing up in our corrections to the propagator. And when you go through the DRG improvement, you get, perhaps not unexpectedly, you get this. But the domain of validity is now just epsilon has to, the only thing is that epsilon has to be less than 1. So let me do that. Let me take our two-point function that starts off looking like this. I'll DRG it. I exponentiate this bit. And what I get is this correction. So I get the standard piece to h over 2k cubed, and I get a new piece over here. And the important part, well, one of the important things to notice is this power delta depends on what my new infrared physics is going to be. But it also is positive. L is large. This is positive. So the infrared singular behavior has been softened. Okay? So the question now is, if I look at this, what is the infrared physics that's doing this? Now, what you might have guessed, and in fact, in the discussion, it's already kind of become clear, does this look like what a mass would do? Right? And so we did the calculation where we start off with a theory with a mass. So these are now, for small masses, these are the zeroth order two-point functions. We computed the one-loop correction and then used the DRG on that. And before we do that, we can now see that we can identify what that log of mu L piece is in terms of the masses in the theory. And when you do the DRG on this, what you find is that you get a piece that looks, this is what you had before, this is a new piece that you get from the DRG. And what you can argue then is that in fact, in the case that we did in 5/4, the new physics that's showing up is the generation of a mass. So we're actually seeing this generation of this dynamical mass. And in fact, just because time is growing short, the dynamical mass that you generate is a set, you know, for epsilon small. So basically, I can neglect this bit and just keep this. For epsilon small, the actual dynamical mass that you generate is exactly the mass that you would have gotten from solving the gap equation or from looking at the stochastic result. And in fact, from that, assuming that if you look at the mean field case, and you look at, say, that the mean field mass is 1/2 lambda times expectation value of phi squared, you can actually use these two results to get the standard result for the expectation value of phi squared in the sitter. So the DRG is actually doing, it's actually exhibiting, at some level, it's exhibiting this, it's doing this resummation, generating your gap equation, generating your mass for you. And it's identifying what the physics is. In fact, I mean, had I not known that that was supposed to happen, had I not known that I was supposed to do a gap equation, I just knew the DRG, I would have actually found this, and I wouldn't have to worry about what diagrams to look at. The DRG, just like the standard RG, the DRG just picks out the leading logs, period. And I don't have to say, oh, it's the sum of bubbles, the sum of anything. I can just actually go directly and get that result. So we've done it for, we did it also for large N, and we get answers that look just like the standard large N answers. And then we decided, well, what happens in theories where you know that that mean field is going to break down? So suppose I look at a cubic potential. I expect mean field to go horribly bad because the potential is inbounding from below, et cetera. And so if I look at the two-point function in these theories, and I compute the one-loop corrections, and I DRG that, what do I get? Does it look like a mass is being generated, or what? And what you find is that it does not look like a mass is being generated, pretty much how you hoped it would have been. Because had a mass been generated, that would have been interesting in any number of ways, but it doesn't. And it's not a surprise, as I said, because the potential is ill-behaved. So, just a couple more slides. The DRG resums the secular terms in the two-point function. It automatically picks out the leading logs. I don't have to worry about what diagrams to look at. For the quartic potential, it's exactly what people have been talking about. I see the generation of a dynamical mass for the theory, and the same mass that you find from either gap equations or a stochastic program. And the DRG can distinguish between different types of infrared physics, say quartic versus cubic potential. So just quickly, other things to do. You can read those. One I want to look at just quickly here is, it's still not, you know, so you're solving a gap equation, but somehow what this smells like is you're starting off with a theory with no mass and somehow generating a mass. And that's what you usually see, for example, in the Coleman-Weinberg. If you have a Coleman-Weinberg type potential, you start off with a pure 5/4, and then somehow, by looking at one loop corrections, you generate a dynamical mass. And at some level, that's what it seems like that's happening here. And of course, if I look at 5 cubed in Coleman-Weinberg, that doesn't happen. It still stays bad. But I don't turn it around. Another thing is that because I generate this dynamical mass, the propagator is less infrared singular, and then you can ask questions, and I didn't think these are the questions that are being brought up here. How does that feedback in to issues having to do with the breakdown of the loop extension?
So I have a really dumb question. I mean, in just a scalar field theory, you generate a quartically divergent contribution to the mass. Did you tune that away?
Right. Right. Yeah. That's ultraviolet physics. We're just getting rid of that.
You just tuned that precisely away.
Okay. So that's all I have to say on this. Thank you.
I'm not sure who's going to be left on Friday, so a couple of comments. One is, you mentioned this mess in sort of extracting the leading IR effects from the diagrams, and I just wanted to mention that there's a simple way to get the leading IR dependence via these semi-classical relations, and I'll talk a little bit about that on Friday. And that also generalizes, is very general and includes the curvature and tensor fluctuations where you see a similar apparent breakdown. So I'll leave the rest for Friday.
Could you mind, please, how do you get the mass equation? Is it some minimization or
no?
Will you write it loopwise?
So here is, so how do I get the sort of the dynamical mass?
Gap equation.
Right.
You mentioned.
No, and so I don't get the gap equation. I don't get, we don't do it that way anyway. We correct the propagator. We ask questions like, so for example, when does the effect due to the quartic coupling dominate over just having a mass? So that gives us sort of this relationship. And, let me put it differently. When I look at this, I can say that, in fact, the coupling is coming in such a way as to give rise to an effect that would look like a mass. Remember that this epsilon is m squared over 3h squared. So this looks like 2m squared over 3h squared, and this looks like something. If I just say the question, well, what is the effective mass that this thing is looking like? It's this. But I know what delta is. I have delta here. So it's this and then this relation. So I'm just getting it by looking at how the coupling corrects the two-point function. It's equivalent to doing the gap equation, but all I've done is, I mean, technically I've re-summed diagrams, but all I've really done is just DRG.
What happened to capital L that just disappeared at some point?
Capital L got identified because I looked at... Yeah. So I looked at the massive but light field case, and I did the correction, and I get this. And then I say, oh, this looks just like what I had before, but before I had a log mu L here. So I made the identification between log mu L and this. So, which was telling me that already this L was related to massness of the theory.
Any other questions? Okay, in that case, let's thank Richard.